and welcome to Games with Garfield. I'm your host, Jessica Price. I'm here with Scaff Elias.
Hello.
And Richard Garfield.
Hi.
And very excitingly, we have a special guest tonight, Mark LeBlanc.
Hi there.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Well, I'd be happy to introduce Mark.
Okay, great.
Start off. I first met Mark several years ago.
1999.
And it was at the GDDC, DDCA. What was it called back then?
I don't remember, but it's the Game Developers Conference now.
Yeah, and I think I first met him when he was giving a talk, and I was overall pretty depressed with the quality of the talks at the conference. Marx was talking exactly about what the sort of thing that I was interested in, which was game design.
Right. That was the feedback systems and dramatic structure talk.
So can you give us a summary?
The talk was about two topics. One was about the sort of the engineering concept of a feedback system, like a thermostat, a system that drives itself towards or away from a particular state, and talking about that as a game dynamic as opposed to just an engineering dynamic, and then talking about dramatic structure in games and how the two things are related, that in fact feedback systems can be used to modulate dramatic tension in games by bringing games closer together or driving them further
dramatic
apart.
Dramatic structure as in narrative?
Yeah, as in the tension mounting towards a climax. Yeah.
Do you have any feelings on that, Scaff?
Only negative ones.
I'm not talking about story, though, Scaff. I'm talking about a sense of drama.
Oh, only positive ones.
Oh, okay.
The topic was fascinating. Right. It was exactly the sort of thing which I wanted to talk about, which
right.
was something about the structure of games.
Right. So this balding guy came up to me and wanted to talk to me about stuff, and I gave him my cell phone and nearly blew him off, and then I saw his badge with his name on it. I was like, oh, I should pay attention to this guy.
So what you're saying is you blow people off unless they're famous?
You caught me.
So your Wikipedia entry, because that's how I do my research, says that...
Not written by me.
I wrote it.
Oh, okay. Says that you were a master assassin in the MIT Assassin's Guild.
Yeah,
what
right.
is the Assassin's Guild?
The MIT Assassin's Guild does real-time, real-space role-playing, which is these days called LARPing, although I think they still prefer real-time, real-space role-playing.
Do you have to get a secret tattoo?
There's no secret tattoo.
Is there a secret handshake?
There's sadly, there's no secret handshake.
The guild is disappointing me already.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Well, maybe I'm not telling you about the secret handshake.
Okay.
Maybe I'm just denying the secret handshake.
I can get
hang out
that.
With Mark a little bit, and you'll find out his tattoo is far from secret.
There you go.
You'll wish you hadn't.
Yeah.
So live-action role-playing.
It's a live-action role-playing. It's actually an unusual format because a lot of the games, at least in my day there, a lot of the games were 10-day live role-playing games with, you know, 90 people over the course of, ranging over the entire MIT campus. So,
wow. So have you seen The Wild Hunt?
The Wild Hunt.
It's a movie that just came out. It was at the Seattle International Film Festival, and it's about LARPing gone wrong.
Ah, interesting. I happen to be in a WoW guild called The Wild Hunt.
Interesting.
Coincidentally, but I'm pretty sure it's unrelated. Yeah.
No, so do you have any funny LARPing stories?
I don't know if they would make sense in out of context, but I'll try. There was one particular episode I remember where, you know, I was having sort of a secret meeting with a guy, and, you know, we were pretending to be chums, but we're really adversaries, and so we were talking about some third guy and how that guy was clearly a bad guy and we needed to deal with him. So he's like, I guess we had this plan that we were going to like tranquilize him and interrogate him under truth serum and stuff like that, which is what you do in these games.
Nice.
And so we got together to form the plan, and I was like, I can get some truth serum if you can get some money, right? And so we arranged to make an exchange of truth serum for money, and later we showed up, and I showed up with fake truth serum and he showed up with counterfeit money.
Nice.
And we made the trade. And then, of course, you know,
trust is
when,
such a beautiful
when
thing.
The thing went down, we all turned on each other and it turned into a big firefight, and, you know, there was lots of...
So this sounds fun to return to, because I've got some things about LARPing I'd be interested in talking about, but I don't feel like we properly introduced you, because
we got to the part of
you gave a fascinating game design talk, and so,
right.
so we were on the same
and then we were off.
You mean we're not here just to interview Mark because he LARPed at MIT for a while?
Precisely. I'm afraid I don't have your Wikipedia entry, but what I remember is mm-hmm. Looking Glass Games.
Right. Looking Glass Studios for...
Were you at the time I met you, were you at Looking
Glass? Right, I was at Looking Glass. Yeah. That was right before they closed their
and
doors.
So that's Thief and System Shock?
The Thief games, the System Shock games, the Flight Unlimited games, the Ultima Underworld games.
Yeah. One of my favorites, Bioshock.
Bioshock, so. Yeah, that's...
I hear it's just a prettier System Shock.
It's, yeah, in some sense. It's I mean, Ken Levine is the sort of... mastermind behind both System Shock 2 and BioShock. So it really is a spiritual successor.
I personally was a big fan of both the System Shock and the Thief. I didn't play the others,
right,
to my knowledge. I just downloaded one of the Thiefs. Unfortunately, I found out it was one of the very later ones rather than much earlier ones. But for my son, and he's been playing it. Was it the first stealth shooter?
It was pretty much the first-person stealther. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's definitely the first-person stealther. Metal Gear Solid came out around the same time. Our game was more simmy. Metal Gear Solid is more video gamey.
Uh-huh.
And Metal Gear Solid is third person, whereas we're first person stealther, for better or worse.
So let me clarify. It's a first person shooter where you sneak through like all the levels?
More or less. I mean, there are combat options, but you're a thief, and you know, you're trying to get in and get the loot and not get seen and get out. And,
I love sneaking.
Yeah.
In fact, if you play it on the hardest setting, you're on a lot of the levels, you're not allowed to kill anybody, right? Although you had the undead level.
Right, there were some undead levels.
So you
can
still have a taste of combat.
Right. Sometimes Thief meant Tomb Raider in a certain sense, yeah.
Now, professionally, after that, I lost track of you except for Oasis.
Right.
Which I found a few years later, and I didn't realize you were involved with. But Oasis is exactly in that area of games which I'm very interested in, which is games which are not all the way to traditional computer simulation style games, but they feel like they've got their roots in paper games.
Right. Oasis is kind of like a board game that you couldn't do on a board.
Yeah.
Or would be very awkward to do on a board because it has lots of hidden information and things like that. Yeah, Oasis was the idea for Oasis came from Andrew Leaker, and he was sort of the inventor of Oasis. And I was at Visual Concepts at the time, which was a Sega of America studio. They later became 2K Games, but I was at Visual Concepts at the time, and I saw Andrew Leaker's little prototype of Oasis, and I decided to leave my job to go help him bring that to fruition.
So can you give us a brief description? How do you play Oasis?
All right. The three-word description is Civilization meets Minesweeper.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's what everyone says. So the longer description is, Andrew, his original intent was to make the anti-Minesweeper, right? In Minesweeper, one of the problems is that every time you click, you're risking death, right? So Minesweeper, every click is potentially bad, right? And you want to like use your clicks very sparingly to get information so that you can survive the level. And it's all about surviving the level. And so Andrew wanted to make a game that's like Minesweeper, where clicks give you information, but every click is good. And so every click is good. And the question is whether your good clicks add up enough to win the level. So in Oasis, you're returned back to your kingdom and it's covered with fog of war, essentially. And every click removes a little bit of fog and gives you a little bit of information about what the map underneath the fog is like. And so you can find crops, which will lead you to cities. And once you find your cities, you can connect them together with roads. Your cities will grow over time as you connect them with roads. And you can also find mines, which let you let you develop technologies and things like that. And the whole point is to spend your 85 turns, the 85 clicks you're allowed, to build up to explore and build up a good enough empire so that when the barbarians come, at the end of the 85 turns, you've survived. You've survived their assault. Yeah, yeah.
And even though this game was released 5 years ago?
Yeah, it was released in 2004, I think. Yeah, almost, 2005, I think.
It's almost perfect for iPad.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, it's the game that we were designing for iPad before anyone knew that there were going to be iPads.
Gosh, I wish I had a copy of it on my iPad.
Oh, well, funny thing you asked that, Richard. We just launched on the iPad this week. On Monday, we hit the App Store, flew through the through the review process, actually, surprising all of us. And the game on the iPad is called Defense of the Oasis. And the original Oasis had the misfortune of having the same name as a very popular rock band. And so it's kind of lost in Google searches. So we wanted to give it something a little bit more distinctive so that people could find it more easily.
Do you have a website for the game?
OasisGame.com is the website for the game.
So everybody, go visit OasisGame.com.
Or just type Defense of the Oasis into Google, and you will find your way into the App Store, and you can buy it for your iPad.
I wonder if people are going to think it's a tower defense game, since tower defense has co-opted the name defense.
Yeah, I, you know, I think I'm okay if people who are searching for tower defense find our game. I think they'll enjoy it.
I think there's a
lot of overlap, not necessarily in terms of style of play, but in terms of audience. I think so.
It's a very original game. People who listen to our podcast would probably really enjoy it.
So that is oasisgame.com.
Oasisgame.com. Indeed.
I'm playing Scaff this week.
Or the Apple Store.
Apple Store. Defense of the Oasis. Yep.
So my introduction now has hit 3 points. Game Thinker, Smart, Looking Glass, Thief, and then Oasis.
Right.
So you, is there something else you'd like to fill in before we get sucked off into some other area of game design?
I'm currently the CTO of a small company called Mind Control Software. We've done a bunch of things. Oasis is one of the things we've done. We did Field Commander for the PSP. We're currently working on a Facebook game based on a major TV science fiction show that I probably can't identify right now. We'll figure it out at some point, yes. Yeah.
So speaking of being a thinker and being smart, your Wikipedia entry talks about the Mechanics Dynamics Aesthetic, or MDA framework.
Right. So I've been running a game design workshop at the GDC since 2001. Actually, Richard and Scaff were on the original faculty of that.
We did that for 2 years, I think?
Maybe.
I think it was 2 years.
Yeah, I recall you running a rock, paper, scissors tournament with cash prizes, I seem to recall.
Nice.
That's probably true. Yeah. I remember the tournament.
Was it a Ready, Aim, Fire? Tournament?
No. Rock, paper, scissors, because we were
I think you played Ready, Aim, Fire, which determined seeding for the rock, paper, scissors tournament. Maybe, I don't know.
So if you had 3.5 minutes to explain MDA framework.
Well, the MDA framework views games in three terms, in sort of three views. The mechanics of the game, the dynamics of the game, and the aesthetics of the game. So the mechanics of the game are what we normally think of as rules, right? It's the description of what you need to play. So it's not just the rules, but it's also the equipment and the circumstances. And I use the word mechanics instead of rules so that I can sort of get away from the connotational baggage of the word rule, right? So we don't have to argue about whether gravity is a rule of baseball. We can say that gravity is a mechanic of baseball because we're defining the word mechanics, okay? By aesthetics, what I mean is just all of the pleasures of play, all of the emotional reasons to play a game, right? What the game designer is hoping you experience emotionally when you play the game. And I use the word aesthetics instead of fun for similar reasons, so that we don't have to argue about whether Schadenfreude is fun or whether catharsis is fun or things like that.
Oh, Schadenfreude is fun.
Well, it's for half of us.
Well, yes.
Games have mechanics, the rules and the formal structures that they're made out of, and they have aesthetics, which is sort of what the objective of playing, and then the dynamics is the thing in the middle, which is the activity, which is what happens when you play, right? And dynamics are a very important part of game design. We're in some sense, I like to think of it as a game designer, we're kind of playing telephone. We're kind of talking to the player through that, you know, tin can telephone, right? And the dynamics of the game, the behavior of the activity is like the string, right? It's the level of interaction between us and the player. And so MDA is just a framework for talking about game design. It gives you sort of three bins in which to put different kinds of game design knowledge. Knowledge of mechanics, knowledge of dynamics, knowledge of aesthetics. And there's also a fourth bin, which is sort of the knowledge of the interactions between those things.
Yeah, it's an area which is really of a lot of interest to us. And the reason I was looking for some things like this when I went to the GDC back in the day was because at the time, we were thinking about the fact that game design lacked the huge educational structure that went on with narrative. Like if you go to into film school, you've got all this educational background on things to do with narrative. And with games, you don't have that. You don't have that language. And so people use the same words for different things, and they use them muddily. And so. And these days, they're sort of getting much more defined.
Right. I think that in back in 1999, the thing that we were struggling with most is that in the community, particularly the digital game community, there was people had trouble making this distinction between descriptive knowledge and prescriptive knowledge. Like, if you said feedback systems cause drama, like, everyone thought you were making a prescription. You were saying your game sucks if it doesn't have a feedback system, and it sucks if it doesn't have drama. And, you know, everyone sort of assumed that every descriptive statement was a prescriptive statement. Uh-huh. And so a lot of what MDA was trying to do, or what MDA grew out of, is just the idea of acknowledging that, hey, there are different aesthetics. There are different objectives you might have. And for each set of objectives you might have, there are descriptive things we could say about those objectives.
Yeah, and that's actually very similar. Richard and I teach a course at UW that certainly has that as one of its primary driving reasons to talk, I guess is the best way to say it.
I was just about to ask whether it had been picked up by academia.
No, I would say barely would be the answer to that. I think it's something that, you know, maybe 20 years from now you might look up and say, yes, it was picked up by academia, but I think in general it's in its earliest stages of being sort of broadly picked up by academia.
Every once in a while I do the vanity search for mechanics, dynamics, aesthetics, and you find some wonderful things. And one thing I found a review of some book which basically said this approach to game design is way better than that mechanics, dynamics, aesthetic crap they're teaching in schools. So clearly are teaching it in schools, and that's what I got out of it. And in fact, I think if you go to certain places like CMU or possibly MIT, you know, or a place like that, you'll hear.
No, there's definitely a few places. Having known this through sort of working on it through the university and people, the people who are responsible for that starting that program there, it's, you know, there's a half dozen places where it's taught, I think, sort of well or seriously.
Right.
And then, you know, and it scales down pretty quickly from there.
Game design theory is definitely the Wild West right now, you know.
Sort of like the internet.
Anything goes.
Yeah,
it's fun time to be doing it. Certainly,
it's really the thing is, as Richard points out, it's sort of surprising when you look at games both sort of in the place that they take in our society in terms of how much time people spend playing them and how much money people spend on them, and then compare that to the amount of academic. Of any sort of academic study of it, and it's a glaringly ridiculous ratio compared to other things. So
if you had to pick a favorite of the games that you've designed, I know this is like asking a parent to pick their favorite child. It's okay. Not fair, but.
But somebody pick one, Sophie.
But pick one anyway.
Okay, I need to clarify that a lot of design is a team effort, especially in digital games, right? And in many of the projects I've worked on, my capacity has largely involved typing braces and semicolons, right? I have kibitzed on design, I've contributed to design, but my primary function in a lot of cases is either writing code or hiring other people to write code and then taking credit for it.
The latter sounds like a pretty nice gig.
Yeah, well, that's what the CTO really means. But I would have to say Oasis, because I would say that Oasis probably is the game that I've had the strongest influence and probably the most positive influence on in terms of design. There's a kind of a joke at my current company, which is that I am not a game designer, I am a game redesigner. I'm not going to be the guy who comes up with your awesome idea. I'm going to be the guy who identifies the cool nugget of goodness in your idea and brings it out and accentuates it. So, and I guess that's what at Wizards you guys call development, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. On some level.
We felt that it was one of the, on average, it's hard to, you don't want to generalize too much, but it's kind of, the average game is underdeveloped. So I mean,
right.
That's the most egregious sort of place where it could be improved for most games.
Right.
Right.
I think games in general almost should be underdeveloped slightly, but...
Slightly?
But not massively.
Yeah, I mean, you can get into the too many cooks in the kitchen.
Right.
So, clearly, you've got a lot of roots with paper games as well, though. Just before we began this podcast, in fact, we were testing a prototype of yours, a paper game prototype. Mm-hmm. And then every time we get together, we talk about what board games we're playing.
Right, right.
So do you see a strong link between your work in the digital space and your work in board games?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I certainly see play as a continuum. I mean, if you're going to be a sort of literate, well-read game designer, I think that you need to read the classics. I think you need to play board games, and I think you need to play sports, you know, and you need to play at a casino every once in a while. And
LARPs.
And LARPs, sure. Sure,
all
absolutely.
Comes back to LARPing.
Yeah, and tabletop role playing and all that stuff. I think that there's a lot of play that transcends media, right?
So what haven't digital games fully absorbed yet from paper games that they should?
Well, I mean, I don't think that digital games have really figured out how to get people around a table yet. I mean, I think that's the big thing. I think the face-to-face aspect of it, I think, hasn't been absorbed. And I think a little bit, I think that digital games, you know, I've been playing a lot of League of Legends and things like that. And if you look at WoW and things like that, I think that digital games are kind of the Wild West when it comes to sportsmanship. I think that sport...
Well, that's that ties directly into your not around the table thing with
right.
Anonymity breeds evil.
Right, right. I mean, maybe not the Wild West. Maybe
the heart
it's
of darkness.
Yeah, post-apocalypse. My League of Legends status is permanently set to, you know, you have a little status line that says, you know, it's like a Twitter status or whatever. But mine is set to sportsmanship : look it up. Yeah. And yeah. Well, I kind of fear for the next generation.
We consistently tell our students that Joseph Conrad wrote the definitive book on internet social structures, which is Heart of Darkness.
Sure.
Right.
More than 100 years ago. And it really is like that. Anonymity really... the fact that someone's not going to leap across the table and punch you in the face, it's surprising how much that's actually a real constraint
right.
for people.
Like, imagine if you were sitting around your kitchen table playing D&D and, you know, a bunch of people, like, just sort of looked around and said, oh, I think the mage isn't pulling his weight. I think we should kick him from the group. Like, you know, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Are you sure?
Yeah, we've played with a player, a guy called Javier, that we think sometimes he thinks we're not in the same room. He thinks he's anonymous and over the internet.
Right.
That's our best explanation for what he's doing.
Right, right.
And if your D&D game was taking after online also, you'd be playing the game and every time you'd leave, somebody would come in and just sit in your chair just to be annoying or just knock it over. Or maybe take a crap on it.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that getting rid of the anonymity actually, I think it helps, but I'm not sure it's going to solve all the problems
being
jerks.
I mean, it's not just the anonymity, right? It's the distance, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know if anyone here has been following it, but there was a major internet firestorm because Blizzard was going to be using Real ID on their forums, so your real name was going to be exposed if you posted on the forums. And it was an attempt. Blizzard's forums are sort of calling it the Wild West or Lord of the Flies, I think, would
well,
be
the
putting
biggest,
it kindly.
The problem with that is that no doubt the biggest forum troll is Stephen Colbert, right? Like, and he doesn't want his real name.
Right. Okay. But yeah, so they... I think we're trying to fix that by saying that.
But they had to back off it.
Yeah.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah, Lord of the Flies. Wild West. Lord of the Flies might be better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That's good.
Especially for gaming.
What's the internet equivalent of the conch? There is none. It's Lord of the Flies. Sans conch.
Kill the pig. So one other game I wanted to mention. Did you work on Stomping Ground?
I did work on Stomping Grounds a little bit. I mean, that was mostly Andrew Leaker's gig. That was Andrew's. That was Andrew's baby.
Was that was after Oasis?
That was after Oasis. It
was a pretty original idea.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. I think I agree with the people who say it kind of suffers from its subject matter because it's this game about, you know, jungle animals, you know, fighting each other using mechanics very similar to a, you know, Final Fantasy or Fire Emblem or some, you know, like I swing at you, you swing at me kind of resolution.
But the mechanics were very elegant and it was
right.
Very fast. It wasn't like...
I agree.
And there was something, I haven't played it for a while, but there was something really pretty original about it. Like you didn't choose your opponent or you didn't choose who you were fighting with.
Right.
Some sort of semi-random matching between who was fighting who.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's kind of like an initiative system where like randomly, there's a random lottery for who gets to attack now. Right. And then if... that's your guy, then you get to choose who he attacks, but you don't get to choose turn order. There's sort of like a random lottery for who's going to get the next turn. Yeah.
Yeah. And it worked really well. I've never played it multiplayer. I don't think when we got it that was enabled.
Yeah, it probably wasn't. But we haven't released.
Like it would be.
We have a multiplayer version in house, and for business, there's business constraints on us releasing the multiplayer version, but it's possible that those are getting lifted. So we'd like to do that. The other thing about Stomping Grounds that I want to point out is the, it's a game. You have this sort of army, if you will, of animals, and you send them into combat in multiple rounds, and an animal that goes into combat in one round has to rest the next round, and an animal that gets injured in combat has to rest for two rounds. So there's almost, I like to think of Stomping Grounds as almost a sports management game, right? Yeah. Where you're managing your kind of like lines and...
That was something actually that I remember. That was something I really liked, because in the Final Fantasy style game, you use your guy, it's kind of annoying because you've got sort of these optimum armies and you kind of want to play with the others, but you don't want to spread out your experience. And,
right.
They sort of twist themselves up with these scenarios to force you to use certain guys.
Right, right.
But it was very elegant in Stomping Ground. You had to sort of manage your guys, like, as you said, like a sports manager.
Right, right. You need to have the rhinoceros depth chart. Yeah.
Right, and so the lion's out this round because he's injured, and the rhinoceros is out because he's been betting on dogfighting.
Right.
You have to decide to make up for that.
Right, so to go to something base here. So where would somebody go to play Stomping Grounds? What platforms is it for?
It's available on PC only, I think, and I believe you can go to our website, mind-control.com, and you can download it from there.
And it's going to be only single player.
It's going to be only single player for now.
Yeah. So you might look for that. It's mechanically really an interesting game and a lot of fun. And my son liked it a lot when he was 8. So it goes pretty. Even though there's a lot of strategy, it goes pretty young.
Right.
So what are you working on right now that you're most excited about?
Well, I'm excited about this this Facebook science fiction game that I can't
talk tell us about.
Much about. So,
another base question. So, if someone wanted to read more about your MDA stuff, where
you would go to the number 8 kindsoffun.com, and you can find all of the slides from all of my lectures, including the 1999 one where
so
I met Richard.
So where are slides from that from those times, those lectures, Richard? Because we gave lectures. Where are our slides? Are they available online? Oh, no, that's right, because we were the only people at GDC
expression.
Who asked for an overhead projector and drew them on transparencies.
Oh, right. I remember that. I went to that talk.
That is right. These days, I've moved to the modern world. I'm making slides. Been beaten down. No more overhead transparencies. I wanted a chalkboard. Can you bring me in a slate, please?
Well, actually, in my workshop, I often use a flip chart. You know, an easel pad. And in many ways, I prefer that to the whiteboard. I guess the chalkboard is even lower tech than that. But in many ways, I prefer that to the whiteboard because I can actually flip back. I can flip, I can erase and unerase, right? Save and restore.
Right. Right. And with chalkboard, you have the mathematician's disease, which is white lung.
right.
But the still the best system, is the chalkboards with where you hit the button and they move, slide them up, because then you have all the advantages of the flipboard.
Right.
Plus you can erase on the fly and add things into your drawing, which is very, that's what we were doing with the transparencies.
Right.
And in either case, it's just way better than the fancy stuff that involves semiconductors of any kind.
I remember one lecture from one of the other graduate students when I was in math, that he was an incredibly sloppy writer, and he was writing with his piece of chalk, and it was illegible, and the chalk broke. It shattered because he grips it so hard. And then he reached down and he grabbed a piece of purple chalk because that was the other color. And then he begins writing, and he just writes over the top of what he was doing before because he can see both. And so now you've got this sort of half a lecture here on the board in yellow chalk, and then you've got half of it written in purple chalk, and you have to change your focus to see what he's writing.
Oh, dear.
Chalk is very flexible.
But so, we can find your high-tech slides at 8kindsoffun.com.
Awesome.
And that is numeral 8, not
now,
8 spelled
out. Now, is it mainly your stuff up there? Is there other people's stuff up there? Because the MDS is very interesting.
It's so. It's materials from the workshop that I run at GDC is up there. And so, because I run that with 9 other faculty, other faculty members will contribute materials, and those materials are generally up there also. So they'll be there. There are a lot of exercises and activities that I run at the GDC.
Are they up there? Can
they're
somebody
all up there.
Educate themselves from
you
your website?
You can educate yourselves. In fact, you can run a workshop yourself by downloading those materials and getting some friends together and just going through the exercises.
All right, listeners, go forth.
If you want to run a workshop in, I believe, Korean, I believe you can send me an email, mahk@8kindsoffun.com. And I can hook you up with the guy who has translated several of the materials into, I believe, Korean. But I could be wrong about which,
but you're not sure.
Which Far Eastern language. I'm pretty sure it's Korean, yeah.
Excellent. So for our Korean-speaking listeners, whom I'm sure there are many.
Who want to run a workshop.
Yes, who want to run a workshop.
Based upon, yes.
Yeah.
Those slides are available to you in your native tongue.
Another project that might be worth talking about, since we have some readers on our blog site who are aware of it, was MindTwist.
Right.
So I worked with, MindTwist was a project I was doing with Mind Control,
right.
And I did work some with Mark on this project.
Sure.
What did you think of that?
Honestly, I wasn't convinced at first. It seemed very small in terms of its design space. But once I got into it, once I kind of saw what the possibility space, what the design space really was in terms of what characters you can create and things like that, then it started to really open up. It opened up to the point where now we had to start thinking about how exactly would we communicate all this stuff on an iPod to somebody. And the answer is to do it on an iPad.
Just make the screen bigger.
That was the first game prototype I played where we had to have a spreadsheet set up next to the game when we were playing it at first.
Right.
Until we got the information.
Right, and then we built the annotated version where the iPod screen was in the upper left corner and just all surrounding it was like all this mouse over text for, you know, what pieces did what and things like that.
Fortunately, we got friends like Rob Watkins who
doesn't
mind playing spreadsheet games.
Yeah.
So he got us through the first part.
Right.
How many projects like that have you been involved with over the years where, I've been involved in lots of games like that which sort of look promising and, you know, maybe they get resurrected at some time or another, but they go into stasis for indefinite periods of time. Is that something you're really used to?
I would say so at Mind Control, definitely. At Looking Glass, we were doing more AAA games, so games didn't get very far unless they were,
already funded
and things like that. But Mind Control, for one thing, we have some pretty good prototyping tech. So we occasionally will just have a game jam where we'll just spin out and everyone spends 3 days making a game.
Yeah, because of your prototyping, you can afford to sort of get them out quickly.
Right. There was a funny situation where I was working on, someone had an idea for a game and it was supposed to be network multiplayer and I was too lazy to do the network multiplayer code. So instead I found some code on the web to allow you to connect 2 mice to the same computer and just play 2 people on the same computer with 2 mice.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of like, then we had suddenly the multi-mouse game jam where we like tried to think of every game you could possibly make with multiple people at the same computer. Turns out multiple people at the same computer is not so great for a product formulation. Like there isn't that many people who want to play a multiple people each with their own mouse in the same computer game. But if you do, you can go to mind-control.com and download our game R. That's A, 6 R's and an exclamation point. It's a pirate game where basically you have a pirate ship and your mouse cursor is the wind. So
this gives me a chance to, well, finish what you're saying, but this gives me a chance to segue into my favorite interview question ever.
Okay. I'm not sure I have anything more to say if it's your favorite
all
interview
right.
question ever.
Pirates or ninjas? I feel that this question, that people's answers to this question
gotta
reveals
go with
a
pirates.
Lot about them.
I'm sorry. I got to go with pirates.
You're a pirate guy, huh?
Yes.
Richard?
Pirates or ninjas?
Mm-hmm. Which are better?
Ninjas.
I'm with you on the ninjas.
It's a silly question.
It's
Mark.
Not a
Pirates
silly question.
Pirates are real. They had real fun. They really did cool things. Yeah, ninjas are.
Well,
what are
no,
they're,
but
they're
hey,
jokes.
No. Listen,
I mean,
listen.
I guess the question.
No,
even if the question is canonical movie pirates versus canonical movie ninjas,
no,
I still go with
ninjas,
pirates.
Ninjas, the whole thing is secrecy and sneakiness. They could be having tons of fun, and you would never know.
They could be disguising themselves as a head.
If
right
they
now.
Were having tons of fun, they wouldn't mind telling people about it.
They would, though. They just don't want you.
One of my favorite Onion videos is the one that is Ninja Parade goes by unnoticed for 10th year in a row.
That's good. No, I mean, I think I'd actually go for robots over both of those. But yeah, the thing is that pirates in real life seem like a skanky bunch of smelly...
We're not talking real life here. Okay. We're talking the Hollywood concepts.
If we're just talking about the fiction.
Ninjas in real life are spies.
Right.
Which are, you know, mostly, you know...
Yeah,
guys who listen to things on headphones and, you know, push paper.
Right, we're not talking about reality. We're talking about the Hollywood concepts here.
The Hollywood concepts. I'm still going
I'd
pirates.
Rather watch a pirate movie.
I'd rather be a ninja, though.
Oh, be, yeah, okay. I think so, yeah. Yeah, sure, absolutely. I don't like rum.
Well, yeah, there's that. And I'm not that fond of parrots.
I would rather be a software ninja than a software pirate, although I don't know what that is.
You don't know what a software pirate is? Because I got to tell you.
I know what a software pirate is, okay. But I know what a software ninja is.
Yeah, it does sound like it would be cooler, though.
Yeah,
it does sound cooler. So what else? What is the one thing, you know, speaking of these games that did not make it to the market, like what's the one concept or the one, you know, sort of trait of a game that you worked on that you were really proud of and that you really still want to get out there?
I had this prototype that I actually did at Visual Concepts that I would like to turn into a game someday. And basically the idea there was the thing I felt was missing from Grand Theft Auto was you couldn't really trick out your ride, right? Cars were these disposable things, right? And like the version of Grand Theft Auto where, you know, you got to sort of like grow and mod your car and sort of level it up and maybe mount different kinds of weapons onto it and turn it into a sort of a character separate from you.
That would have just been Grand Auto then.
Yeah, sure.
Grand Theft Auto.
Yes, and it's fantasy, and your car is a monster, but that you ride.
Right.
Right. So that was kind of just the idea of you have a character. Your character, your RPG character, isn't your guy. It's your vehicle. Like, is sort of an idea that that I'd like to play with. And I think that there's a lot of, like, in a lot of games, there's kind of, like, this disconnect between sort of form and function. There's this disconnect, like, in WoW, where I want to wear the you know, effective pants, but I also want to wear the pretty pants, and you can't do both.
I always thought of you as a pretty pants guy.
Pretty pants is so the
name of my
next. That
leads me to my
band.
Favorite interview question.
All right. Bring it on. All right. Do you two have any... more questions for Mark?
Not public.
Mark, do you have anything else you want the audience to know?
Well, I've been talking all day, and I apologize for my voice is going.
Oh, that's okay.
Well, thank you very much for stopping by.
Yeah.
I should re-mention, Oasis is, you know, Stomping Ground, take a look at that, that's cool, but Oasis is out on iPad right now.
And it's called Defense of the Oasis.
Defense of the Oasis.
Defense of the Oasis
and,
at oasisgame.com.
Yeah, you won't be disappointed.
Yeah.
And you should also...
If you've made it through this far through this podcast, you will not be disappointed.
Yes. You should also check out Mark's site at 8 Kinds of Fun. Again, numeral 8, not 8 typed out, for some what I gather from Richard are very interesting and very useful lectures and slides in game design. And
mm-hmm. Yep.
All right.
Great.
Well, thanks
right.
very much
Thank
for joining
so
us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks for having
it's
me.
It's been great. And for our listeners, have a great month or a couple weeks till we talk to you next. And
where we'll talk about chalk some more. These guys will. And protractors, no doubt.
And yes.
Yeah, I like protractors rather than these newfangled graphic calculators.